Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and I want to say a personal thank you to everybody who's been downloading the podcast and listening at their leisure to past editions of the Midweek Roundup. Really appreciate your subscribing there. And also those that are watching live, and thanks again for joining us. It's a great day here in Northwest Ohio. We had our first snowfall just a couple days ago, and dealing with the winter cold a few weeks early. So glad that you're with us today. And as always, I'd like to begin by referring you to a couple of resources that we've developed at SMIE Consulting to help you stay up to date with what's going on. In addition to the roundup here, we also have all the SMIE News Fit to Share e-newsletter. That comes out on Monday morning at 9 a.m. I've posted the link to that in the comments section on the Facebook page, and encourage you to subscribe to that and give us a look and let us know if the newsletter is meeting your satisfaction. We strive to really present a good mix of not only international ed news from the United States but also around the world and how other countries are managing international education issues. And we also, that subscription, again, it's free of charge, comes out on Monday morning at 9 a.m. And three of the stories that we feature here on the Midweek Roundup on Wednesdays will come from the e-newsletter that comes out on Monday. So we go a lot more in-depth here on the Roundup in this type of a live chat format. So we really are looking forward to getting into some of the real meaty issues that are not just impacting the United States, but also impacting other countries around the world. And first up, we're going to look at the most recent Agent Barometer report. And this is a joint project between ICEF and iGraduate. And they have been doing this Agent Barometer for several years now. And the most recent edition just was released in the past week or so. And what we've seen at their ICEF Berlin conference, it had a record number of responses from over 2,000 agencies from 119 countries, the widest geographical distribution ever for this survey. It was administered this past August and September, and unusually large sample size for an agent survey. So the good news is, and this is a bit of a surprise coming out of this iGraduate Agent Barometer. Thank you for joining, Hussein. I hope all's well. We're going to be talking a little bit about Canada in a minute here as it relates to this Agent Barometer report. But in terms of the most popular programs that agents are referring students to at the undergraduate level and postgraduate level. So 78% and 74% of agents that were surveyed are referring students for those programs specifically, followed by English language programs. MBA and diploma programs were fourth on that list. So the three major markets, obviously, for the United States are up there in terms of what agents are sending students to. Are they all sending them to the United States? We're going to be hearing next week the official Open Doors numbers, and we'll have our midweek roundup next week exclusively to a review of the Open Doors data. So looking forward to reconnecting with you all next week on that. But what we see from the ICEF Agent Barometer report of what agents are currently doing this year with their prospective students, where they're seeing interest, where are particular countries up or down, however it might go. The vast majority of agents, more than 80%, whether it was diploma programs, certificate programs, pre-master's programs, high school, all levels of study, more than 80% felt that they would be sending more students abroad in the next 12 months, not less. So that's good. Now, what areas are they pushing the most students toward that they will be sending more students abroad to study in the next year? Undergraduate and graduate postgraduate programs were at the same percentage. 87% of all the agents that were included in the survey indicate that they're looking to send more students abroad in the next year. That's encouraging, followed by 77% for diploma programs. And down the list, about 63% were looking, excuse me, 83% were looking at sending more for MBA programs. Where those are, that's a different story. Now, in terms of destinations, there were almost twice as many agents that were surveyed this year placing students than last year. So it's an interesting mix where they're sending them. In terms of countries, according to the barometer report, notable trends are Canada has become much more popular since last year, with 55% of agents sending students there compared with 45% in 2018. Australia has stable at about 42%, and maybe some signs of life for the United States. We now see, according to the barometer, agent barometer, they've bounced back from a low of 40% in 2018 to 48%. So second only to Canada in terms of bounce back in terms of where agents are sending students. UK has also seen an increase from 37% to 44% now. So these are fairly significant boosts, but there are also some outliers there that may be signs of things to come. Where two-thirds of agents said that Canada has become more interesting, over half, 54%, said the same thing about Germany. So Germany has been rising up in terms of popularity recently, according to the agents that were surveyed. Does that have something to do with the survey being released in Berlin at the ICEF conference there? I don't know. But that's certainly something to keep an eye on in terms of down the road and how that might, what we do here in the United States might be changing in terms of other markets that we're going to have to become increasingly familiar with as we prepare our messaging out to prospective students and their parents. Another feature of the barometer report were what agents perceived were the major concerns for students and parents before departure and then after they've arrived in their destination country for study. The most significant issues pre-departure that students had expressed to their through their agents were financial difficulties, no surprise there, difficulty with language transitions there, and difficulty finding the right accommodations. Of all those three concerns, primary concerns, the only one that was close to the reality in terms of percentages that were still felt that same way once they arrived was the accommodation issue. So that still seems to be one of those areas that institutions maybe are not doing as good enough job in terms of delivering on what they're promising. What seemed to be the where there was the greatest disconnect are on things that, no surprise, after you arrive, things pop up that you don't know what you don't know kind of thing. And the survey reports from iGraduate revealed that issues with cultural differences was the most significant challenge after arrival, with 59% saying that was a major issue. 43% only after accommodation, which was second at 47%, difficulty with the program, academic adjustment issues, was at 43%. Interestingly, the greatest, one of the areas where there was perhaps a little less surprise, but was the issue of safety. And this is, again, a broad base, not just a U.S.-centric survey, but 40% of parents and students were concerned with safety issues, personal safety issues before they left, and only 23% were concerned about that after they arrived, and that was probably the parents more than the students. So interesting to see that, and a little bit of interesting data on that front. So what's as this social media and international education consulting, what we do here at SMIE, one of the things we always look at is how students, parents, agents are responding to marketing strategies of different institutions. What do they hold up as perhaps the most significant reasons to that were very important or important to marketing of partner institutions and schools? This is the agents saying what they saw as the most valuable or most important pieces of the puzzle. Was quick response times to inquiries and applications and regular communication updates, prompt payment of commissions, no surprise there. And then for agents, having a manual with fees and information and training materials, that type of thing. So that's interesting to see that. What agents did confirm is something that I've certainly said for a number of years in terms of regarding social media, that Facebook, according to agents, is the most important social media platform for reaching out to students and to market their programs in general for institutions. 40% say Twitter is the platform not to use, and that's interesting. So compared to 25% say don't use LinkedIn, 22% say don't use YouTube, and only 4% say don't use Facebook. So interesting to see that. Responses on of the responsiveness of institutions regarding admissions and financial aid opportunities were also areas that agents point out as that could be improved in terms of universities. So some interesting data there in the agent barometer, and certainly put the links to it in the comments section so you can check it out from ICEF and iGraduate, see what some of the most significant ideas there that that they've picked out as things to watch out for. Now, next topic, moving on to post-study work in Australia and the UK. We've seen a couple different stories this week. We are always on top of new stories related to post-study work, and whether it's here in the U.S. with OPT and STEM OPT, or the recently reintroduced post-study work, two-year work visa in the UK, and Australia's 45 visa. And we've talked about that at length on these programs and what Canada's obviously been doing with their very much pro-immigration policies. What we do see now is with Australia and the UK, they both have in their international education strategies very significant links to work opportunity embedded in those. And that's something, obviously, we don't have a national strategy here in the U.S., but we do have one of the most generous work opportunity, work visas that exist anywhere in the world with STEM OPT, with up to 3 years per degree level at the bachelor's, master's, and doctoral level, where students can have practical work experience in their field of study that can potentially lead to H-1B and potentially permanent residency down the road. So what reported that with regard to Australia, and they have a recent study that linked both work during a student's time of study and post-study work are very much intertwined in Australia, and that employment rates are high there for students that are working during their study, that it did find that 3/4 of the 485 visa holders, and these are the 45 is our equivalent of OPT, were in full-time or part-time employment. And then Melissa Banks, who's the president of the International Education Association in Australia, that's the term for it. She's come out and said quite clearly, post-study work rights are crucial for Australia to remain competitive in the global education marketplace. The more we can enhance graduate outcomes, the better for all students, education providers, employers, and the broader Australian community. So it's interesting to see a country where obviously dealing with a much smaller number of institutions with 35 universities and a vast number of vocational and community type colleges preparing folks for vocational work. What there is that in Australia, what is different is that while in Australia, as in the UK, as in the US, 20 hours a week is the maximum hours that students can work while they're school is in session. In Australia and the UK, students can work off campus, as well as Canada. Students can work off campus while they're in their studies. So during their course of studies, if they're maintaining employment part-time during their degree studies, then the chances are that they're more likely to be working after they graduate, and potentially at the same jobs they had while they were studying, but perhaps hopefully at a different pay scale. So this is a way that I think is very significant. Obviously, that's probably more easy to do at the vocational level than it is necessarily at the university level, because degree requirements for particular jobs. But certainly the article here from the Pi News, again, one of my favorite sources for international ed news, really does spell out what works and what isn't working in Australia. But the Thai, those that have completed, one of the findings of the study was those who completed their studies in the four biggest fields of education, and for Australia, that's IT, engineering, health, and management, commerce, 26% were working in their field. So that's a little bit interesting in terms of lower percentage if you're looking at it that way. With in Australia, 17% of post-study visa holders were working in low-skilled jobs such as retail, wholesale, and hospitality. Now, what's interesting in Australia, unlike the U.S., there is not a direct correlation between a requirement that students are working in their field of study after graduation. Obviously, in the U.S., that's very much so for curricular practical training before students graduate, and OPT and STEM OPT after they graduate. The requirement is that they be working jobs that are directly related to their field of studies. That's not the case in Australia. So, though there may be more time available in the U.S., there is a much tighter window in terms of what students, or box in terms of what students can actually do when they're working. So very interesting to see what's happening in Australia. It's obviously a different model than we have here in the U.S., but very, very much one that's worth keeping an eye on. Now, another piece of that puzzle, and I've also posted the link to both of these stories, is what's happening in the U.K., and how what one country does directly impacts what another might get out of us impact another country's work policies, post-study work policies. We've reported in the past couple of months, the UK has reintroduced their two-year post-study work visa after students have finished. That goes into place in 2020. And that, according to one of the folks I consult with, IDP Connect, they have released real-time data from the Indian market, which is very significant, number two for the U.S., but also the U.K. and Australia, the number two center to those countries. But for Indian students that are looking at studying outside of India, after this announcement of post-study work reintroduction in the U.K., interest spiked in India for prospective students looking at the U.K. And according to IDP Connect's data, and this is also profiled in a recent Pi News article, that this was based on over 50 million prospective student searches from around the world, showed that, according to the article, immediately after the announcement of the reintroduction of post-study work, Indian students shifted inquiries towards the UK, taking substantial market share from Australia. And that is what these big new policies or reintroductions of old policies that probably should have never been done away with can have on interest in a particular country. Now, whether that eventually leads to enrollments, certainly it will. Whether it will be the same level as what we're seeing with this study as it relates to UK versus Australia, there's real interest. But we also see Canada has also maintained, according to this IDP Connect data, that Canada's resources have actually held strong as well, but it's they've taken away perhaps interest from New Zealand and Singapore. So there's certainly, it's not just the prospective student data from IDP Connect that's seeing in terms of the, a lot of this is coming from Hot Courses data from the different search engine sites that they manage through IDP Connect. That you're also seeing agents on the ground saying the same thing. Look at any, and there's a quote from a country director for Australia that told the Pi that if you look at any agent's webpage on their Facebook promotions, it's all about the UK and the resurgence of interest in study there because of the post-study work opportunities. This particular agency, OECC Global Education, has 13 offices in India, but also in Nepal, Bangladesh, Dubai, and Sri Lanka. The news of this impending post-study work rights had also bolstered interest from Bangladesh and Sri Lanka in the UK. So I'm sure those aren't the only countries, but those are you can see how these national level policy changes directly impact interest in from particular marquee markets. So what we see is that the shift from Australia to the UK would not be simply because of post-study work rights, but because there was a perception that the requirements would be more lenient in the UK than in Australia. Whether that's true or not, that's again the perception, and we all know what perception is in international education when it comes to students around the world. So what we see is that there is some concern, obviously, in Australia that now they're going to be potentially losing market share to the UK from their Indian markets. But we talked about a couple of the stories last week. One of them featured on how that may be happening anyway. It's because Indian students have now been put, along with Nepalese and a couple other countries, have been put into this bucket where they're considered high risk for Australia for visa requirements for funding and English language. So that's a concern there. So we'll see. The September 10th announcement from IDP Connect, just to give you the actual numbers here, so showed that search results to the UK were overtaking Australia to increase by 47%, as interest in Australia decreased 15%. So the IDP Connect CEO, Simon Emmett, has indicated that this current search tendencies were indicative of future enrollment trends over the next 18 months. So that's what we can expect potentially in terms of when those spikes will occur to the UK from India. But it's interesting to see what's happening that and how employment prospects, and this is something we've talked about for months on the Midweek Roundup, and how the idea of employment prospects and how well those are communicated to prospective students in market can make the difference, and that usually are number one or two on prospective students' lists of things that they're most concerned about, and not only for the institution that they're going to, but for the country, and that's maybe where they even start and should be, where they're even starting their searches there. So we'll take a look at some other factors throughout the next few weeks as we get through Open Doors and perhaps a Sivas by the Numbers report from Homeland Security coming out soon. But that post-study work piece is such a critical element in the overall success of particular countries in recruiting students from abroad. And it's something that, because the majority of international admissions folks are not also international student advisors, on their campuses, that there's not always, and they may be in completely separate offices. One of the challenges is on campus, U.S. campuses, is in how well different offices are communicating the values of what they do. And we've talked about it when it relates to job prospects for international students and how you market those in what you send out to international students. Do you even have that kind of data? Or are you using just institution-wide, whatever career services put out for the averages for all students? The international students kind of get the same data, even though the reality for them may be very dramatically different than what the overall university pictures are. So having that communication set up where international admissions folks know what or can get access to data related to their international students, graduation success rates, employment ability, employability and in their field of study, those kinds of things that are so essential to how you market your institution overseas. And I think that's a piece that so many institutions have a disconnect on. Institutions that I've done consult work for, you can see that where there are issues, you can see there's a clear disconnect between student services and the international admissions folks, and even career services, which is often the last part of the institution other than alumni that international students are touching in their time at colleges and universities in the U.S. So there's a lot to do there, a lot more that we'll talk about in the weeks and months to come. A last piece I want to touch on today is related to China. We There's so much we can say almost every week in China, and a number of the articles we had in the e-newsletter that came out on Monday this week were about China and about just the constant stream, not only about Confucius Institutes, but about spying and not only of Chinese students in the U.S., but also in Belgium, in Confucius Institute directors in Belgium were refused entry to the country because they were connected to, they were considered to be spies for the Chinese government. There's other examples in other countries in the UK that where this is happening as well. So we've talked about those before, and I don't want to focus on those essentially because we're not painting a broad brush here. But we're just highlighting these examples around the world where this is happening, and they put them all together, and for some people that turns into, well, that's a place we don't want to be doing business with. But the reality is Chinese students are the number one source of students for not only the U.S., but for Australia, for the U.K., for Canada increasingly. So what we look at with China is how are you, and with a number of institutions we've talked about many times over the last few months, how many institutions in the last decade have kind of gone all in on China in terms of their efforts to recruit students from there, not necessarily their efforts to take care of them once they're on campus, but they've seen the kind of the great halcyon days of 2013, 14, 15, where they were peaking out in terms of their Chinese undergraduate student enrollments. They're now seeing some drop-off, a lot of them. A lot of the bigger, even bigger state schools were seeing drop-offs. But for the mid-sized state institutions, non-flagship, to liberal arts colleges and other big city schools that were doing well in China have seen drop-offs, dramatic drop-offs. The challenge is, okay, what are you going to do differently? Because obviously the definition of insanity, we all know, is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And that clearly won't work. And when it comes to recruiting students, it's even less effective strategy. So what are you doing to change things up and to better address the needs of your, anticipate the needs of your incoming students from perspective, from key markets? What kind of localized content are you using? That kind of thing. So what as it relates to China, there's a lot that can be said. And I've just posted a link to the latest QS article on how to better target Chinese students in your international student recruitment. And there, it's not a hugely in-depth article and one that's fairly light on details, but one that certainly, I think, presents a good sampling of two of the key issues that any institution that wants to be successful in China has to do. These are probably two of the most basic things. And one of those is having customized content, and that is Chinese language content that's specific to them in China, that references certain things in the Chinese education system that they will be familiar with, that has information about, importantly, if hopefully having a locally hosted site of your content. Because of issues that where certain sites are blocked, and how it's always easier when there's a locally hosted version of your content for local students to access, and that in terms of being able to get more directly in front of a broader swath of students that may be interested in your content, and if it's a Chinese language site, if locally hosted and has customized content that targets prospective students, Chinese students, and hopefully their parents as well. And that's not something they mentioned specifically in this article. It's one I would certainly say is an important piece of the puzzle there. So it's important that foreign language information, sorry, you got a site, your key information in Mandarin as well, not just in a PDF, but actually have it locally hosted, have it dynamic, have it interactive. That is something that you want to have if you're looking at China. Obviously, not hosting your videos on YouTube. That's not going to work. Have them on Youku. Have them distributed through QQ and Weibo and WeTalk. WeChat, excuse me. So that these are the things that you need to be doing. And those Chinese social media, this is the other main piece of the puzzle from this QS article, is having that content that is specific to your audience, that is on the Chinese equivalents of Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and we're talking about WeChat, we're talking about Weibo, These are the two that this article identifies. I would throw in UCO as well. But you certainly need to have that presence on those platforms if you want to be taken seriously in country. So it's not just cutting and pasting what you've had on your domestic Facebook page onto a Chinese social media platform. It needs to be customized to that local audience. So again, these are the two main topics that this QS article covers, but certainly ones that I think need to be central to any successful recruitment strategy that involves China. So we're going to cover China a lot more in depth in the weeks and months to come. But for now, I'll just say thanks again for joining us. Download the podcast if you're not already subscribed on Spotify, Podbean, Google Play, or iTunes or Stitcher. We also have this recordings of the Midweek Roundup on our YouTube channel, so you can catch up on past editions. So look forward to connecting with you all in future conferences. But for now, until next week, have a great day.